Fraser on sexual selection in milkweed beetles. Then before doing his PhD at the University of Arizona with Nancy Moran, who was here last year, he studied the evolutionary genetics and sexual selection in gall-forming aphids. Those are the aphids that have soldiers, the eusocial aphids. He then did a PhD at University of Texas, Austin with Ulrich Mueller. Postdoc, sorry about that. There he worked on the molecular genetics, molecular evolution of the mutualism between Ada and their symbiotic fungus. Then he got his position at Vanderbilt, where he's been since, working, I think, continually on these really cool eusocial aphids that he's going to talk to us about today, specifically how cooperation and conflict drive plant-insect interactions.
Thanks, Brian. thank you guys for inviting me. I'll just grab these slides over here real quick. So it's a real honor to be here, and I really appreciate the invitation. Obviously, Davis is on everybody's map for a visit, and so this is my visit, and I appreciate it. I know there's a class that came in right after this, so I'll try to keep a pretty good clip, but you are a friendly crowd because there's a lot of natural history in my talks, and often that natural history trips up some of my molecular and cell colleagues. But again, if there's obvious things that are where you go, I just don't get it, please stop me. But I do want to give time for the class to come in after this. I will start, though, by saying that it is an honor to be here. And actually, I was here once before. But at that time, I was looking for graduate schools. And I was visiting my friend Dirk at the time, and it's been nearly 20 years. And I looked for pictures, but I couldn't find any. Let me acknowledge the people that contributed to this talk today. My grad students, Sarah and Cassidy, and then my buddy and colleague, John Steyerman, who probably a couple of you know, and his graduate student, Jeremy Heath. But I couldn't find pictures, but I did find a picture of me just before I came here. So this is me leaving Simon Fraser University on my way to Davis. And then this is me right after Davis. And the only reason I want to show this is that for those of you that are in my generation or other generations, it is kind of vertiginous what can happen in 20 years, not only to time, but also to your hair, because it's certain things change. And I'm just telling all of you younger people, it happens really fast. Before you know it, you're going to be given a talk somewhere and not realize that 20 years went by. So in those 20 years, I have found myself that I've become interested in herbivorous insects and what they do on plants. And I work on non-model organisms, by and large, and somehow have made a career out of that. My lab studies things like interspecific mutualisms in insects and social evolution. So that's the sort of bookmarks that my lab actually covers. And we ask questions like this. We ask questions like, how do mutualisms spur evolutionary diversification? What are the features that characterize novel mutualistic traits? Likewise, on the social evolutionary front, I ask questions like this. What factors favor the evolution of eusociality? A really broad question that all of us, that those social evolution are interested in. And what are the features that, again, characterize novel social taxa? So what I want to talk to you today about, then, are two things. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I think insect fungal mutualisms evolve in the organisms that I study. And I'm going to tell you a story about carotenoids, gall midges, and fungi. And then I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how herbivorous or phytophagous social insects defend themselves. So I've become really interested in this. And so I'm going to tell you stuff about social aphids, herbivory, and insect immunity. All right, so when we talk about the evolution of insect fungal mutualisms, all of you are familiar with them, obviously. And you think about things like the fungus-growing termites here in the middle, or Attine ants. You might think about bark beetles and their relatives. Some of you might think about wood wasps, perhaps scale insects, and gall midges. And the kinds of questions that people that study these things ask are things like this. How are they associated? So if you look in the literature, you'll typically see a study like this, whereby there's these parallel phylogenies are lined up, and maps are made between who is associated with who. So big scale stuff. They might ask questions like, what do they do for each other? And so in one of my favorite tables here by Jeff Olderton, you might say, what does species 1 on the left do for species 2? And you can make a table like this, and you can say, oh, well, it turns out that what leafcutter ants and their fungi do is they exchange proteins and amino acids for some carbohydrates. Or what aphids and their bacteria might do is exchange proteins and amino acids for physical protection or defense of some sort. And you can sort of make this little table and fill in all these interactions and study these exchanges, right? And so those kinds of questions. And finally, a third question is this: how do they work? How's the machine put together? And it turns out that this has received, in my opinion, less attention, but I think is actually an extremely important aspect of these interactions that deserves more attention. So that's what I want to talk to you today about. So before I talk to you about that, it's worthwhile to make the division between, when we think about mutualisms and we ask how they work, we have to acknowledge that not all mutualisms are alike. So you have mutualisms that are closed and mutualisms that are open. What do I mean by that? Closed mutualisms are situations in which the partners remain together over some long period of time, over generations. So for example, the aphid-Buchnera interaction is obviously a closed mutualism, vertical transmission, no exchange of genetic material between lineages. So essentially an organelle that's inherited over time. Open mutualisms are those where the partners must relocate each other either every generation or every few generations or after each round of reproduction. So for example, the termite fungus mutualism is an open mutualism. And the reason this distinction is important, of course, you can talk about this being a continuum where you can place different mutualisms along this continuum. The reason it's important is because it has implications for the kind of research program that you would conduct to study these types of things. So for example, my PhD advisor invented the study of aphid-Buchnera, basically, with Paul Ballman here at Davis. And questions like this are important, or at least those that are most immediately obvious to ask. So questions, for example, of reciprocal biodiversification. You might ask questions about genomic and metabolic integration between the symbionts. You might study developmental or cellular aspects of interaction, the kinds of cells that the symbionts are encased in. You might ask questions about transport. How are the products of the mutualism moved around? You might ask questions about function, for example. What's the nutrition? But the kinds of questions you ask are going to be physiological in nature. But if you study open mutualisms, you could use the same tools, but there's a whole other set of problems that need to be addressed when you talk about open mutualism. So questions, for example, of macroevolutionary consequences, which may not be immediately obvious like they are over here for closed mutualisms, but nevertheless still important. You might study things about the chemical ecology of host recognition or ecological dynamics or the biogeography of the mutualism. You might look at the selective consequences of host switches or host sharing or ecological interactions between symbionts. You might ask questions about functions, but your questions might, yes, be about nutrition, but there might be ecological aspects of function as well that need to be investigated, right? So, to tell you why that's important, consider, for example, this mutualism. So this is a wood wasp in the genus Syrix, and it has a mutualism with this fungus, Amelosterium, and the wood wasp, as probably many of you know, is in certain parts of its range, particularly in the southern hemisphere, a devastating pest to pine plantations. It introduces a fungus, like bark beetles, to the pines, and then there is rounds of growth and consumption. The fungus grows, the tree gets harmed, and it really is a devastating pest. And the scary thing, of course, is that there's been a recent introduction here of a particular species of Syrix that is causing these devastating effects on pine plantations in South America and South Africa and parts of Europe. And this is a scary thing, and we need to study this. But this is an open mutualism, right? There is some evidence of fidelity between partners, but there's recent evidence, in fact, that fidelity is not very conserved, and there is evidence of host sharing, fungal sharing, new fungal acquisition, movement of symbionts between native species and introduced species, all things that we don't fully understand the mechanisms around which these patterns are being driven. So questions there. really quickly, here's a famous, one of my favorite stories of an open, more open mutualism that's kind of interesting, and I just threw this in because I want to tell you this. This is a scale insect, and it has a mutualism with this genus fungus, this fungus in the genus Septobasidium. And what you're looking at here, so here's the sort of fungal mat that you might see back east. And beneath this fungal mat, and this was studied by Couch back in the early part of the 20th century, what you're looking at here is a cross-section through that mat, right? Has anyone seen this before? It's the strangest thing. I just had to tell you this because it was so strange. So this is the plant down here, right? This is the scale insect here with this long feeding mouth parts here, tapped into the vascular tissues of the plant. Now, it is filled with fungal hyphae, but it's still alive, right? And the fungus is feeding on the scale insect. The scale insect is feeding on the plant. But up here, the fungus has created all these little tunnels, and the offspring of the scale insect are running through these tunnels unharmed by the fungus, okay? If you kill the scale insect, this scale insect, the whole thing breaks down. So it's like a version of like aliens or something, where this live body of this mother scale insect is kept alive by the fungus because she's tapped into the plant, which then feeds the fungus, but the fungus doesn't kill her offspring, instead creates little houses for the offspring. Again, we don't know anything about this interaction, but I would warrant that the functional biology of this interaction is every much as interesting as the Aptine ant fungus symbiosis, which receives a lot more attention. All right, so that then brings me to the gall-forming midges, which I want to tell you about today, which I've studied. So gall-forming midges are flies. They're closely related to fungus gnats. And there are various species. There's about 5,000 described species, which is probably a fraction of the total number of species. And they represent the largest radiation of galling insects on the planet, distributed across four subfamilies. Now, what's really interesting about this for an evolutionary biologist is there's tremendous phylogenetic variation in the kinds of lifestyles these midges have, right? So some midges, ancestrally all gall midges were fungus feeders. They're mycophagous, right? But at some point in the history of the interaction, they made a switch to plants, and they became herbivores, right? Some moved to plants, became herbivores, but they retained the habit of feeding on fungus, right? So they are called ambrosia gallers, because even though they're on plants, they feed on a fungus that they vector to the plant. And these are the ambrosia gallers, and this has evolved multiple times independently within the gall-forming insects. Now some of gall-forming midges, and some in fact have even become predators, and many of you may use gall midges as predators of aphids in your greenhouses. So a well-known member of this group is a predator of aphids. So there's a tremendous amount of dietary variation in these gall midges, and that gives us the chance to use that kind of variation to investigate the evolution of diet in a large scale, right? So these ambrosia gallers are what I'm interested in, these fungus gallers, these gallers that are on plants that eat a fungus. And they have very complex interactions on these plants. So, for example, the one I study galls goldenrod, and it does so just very much like that little scale insect by vectoring a fungus to goldenrod and then depositing an egg, I'll go over this again in just a minute, inside of which its larva then grows and feeds. And it's overgrown by the fungal mycelia. So you're looking at a cross-section through here of the plant. Here's the fungal, the white part. Then inside here's the midge, right? So it's living inside this fungus, feeding on the fungus, while the fungus feeds on the plant. They're completely hammered by parasitoids. So it's not uncommon, and those of you that study these kind of things know this, to find 95% of these midges in a given population don't make it because they're hammered by parasitoids. So they're characteristic. So if you're interested in complex multitrophic interactions, these are really great organisms to study. Now, my partner and I, John Steinerman, have been for a number of years interested in the mechanisms that drive diversity in gall-forming midges. And so With the old caveat is don't worry about the tree here. What I've done here is numbered the species on this tree, okay? And all I want you to take home from this tree is that you can see as much phylogenetic structure within a species as you see between species. So here, right here, is one species called Astromya carbonifera, and you can see as much structure within the species as you see between species, implying there's tremendous amounts of cryptic diversity that has not been described. And this is very typical, not only of golf-worming midges, but many Phytophaga species in general. That's why we probably have a huge underestimate of the number of species on the planet, because there's diversity that we have not accounted for. So we've been interested in what is accounting for or driving this diversity. To those of you that know this kind of stuff, say, well, whatever it is, it's going to be something like this. There's going to be something that happened with the plant. There's going to be something that happens with the gall midge. There's going to be some specialization, some host switches, some evolution of secondary metabolites, some tracking of that, some detoxification mechanisms. All of that's going to be this complex mix of host switches, allopatry, coevolution, escape and radiate, something like that. That's what the story's going to be, right? Well, it turns out it's not quite like that. So we've been interested in asking questions about how these organisms radiate. And a friend of mine, Jeff Joy, published recently a study of gall-forming midges, and what he showed is basically this. He said, if you take all those midges that moved onto plants but didn't bring their fungus with them, so they're herbivores, classic herbivores, and you compare them in a phylogenetically controlled contrast to sister taxa or sister clades that did bring the fungus with them and still use the fungus, what you find is that species that are still feeding on fungus on plants are diversifying at a much higher rate than species that are not. Okay, so just keep the little bubble things are interesting, but really just keep your eye on the black bar here. Diversification rate is much higher in the symbiotic species than in the herbivores, right? So something about having a fungus is making these gall midges speciate faster or diversify faster. So what's going on? Well, Starman and I had been thinking about this for a number of years prior to Jeff's paper, and we had said, this is what I just told you, for any given Phytophagous insect lineage that are on different host plants, there's going to be divergent selection across host plants. There's going to be some kind of niche space, so each different host plant species represents a different niche. They're going to colonize some of those, but there's going to be some constraints that are going to prevent colonization and host switching, so some sort of conservation that's going to prevent radical host shifts. And so there'll be this sort of unexploited niche space out here that's not colonized because the lack of genetic variation to colonize that niche space. So this is just sort of a classic model. You got species, you got divergent selection, nice, okay? But if you take a multitrophic context, you get something like this. You get mechanisms that drive populations into new niche space that you would not otherwise have predicted if you don't take those into account. And we long argued that microbial mutualists might facilitate host switches because, for example, they might provide mechanisms to detoxify plant secondary metabolites that otherwise would prevent the acquisition of novel host plants, for example. And so you might have species that are engaged in complex multitrophic interactions might, in fact, be more diverse than those otherwise that are not, right? So we've basically been studying that in Astromya carbonifera, this gall midge. And so let me tell you the kinds of data that we've actually have found. So Astromya carbonifera galls dozens of these solidago species. It's distributed throughout North America, and it uses a fungus in the genus Botrysferia. So what you're looking at here is adult midge, and then here it's larvae inside these little fungal patches. Botrysferia is an extreme host plant generalist, cosmopolitan, distributed throughout the world, biotrophic pathogen of many, many different kinds of plants. And of course, many of you are familiar with goldenrod. It is not causing your allergies. Okay, so here, common misconception, goldenrod is not responsible for your fall allergies. All right, here's the life cycle of the midge. All right, So you've got two circles here. One is the fungal life cycle, one is the fly life cycle, right? The fly, at some point in its life cycle, through means we don't fully understand, remember what I told you about that host, that chemical ecology of finding your host, open mutualisms, things like that? This is an open mutualism. Finds its fungus somehow, the female inoculates the host plant with both the fungus and makes a wound in the plant, puts its egg in there, the fungus rapidly grows over the developing larvae, pupates in the gall, emerges, she mates, and then somehow relocates the fungus again, and or in this new sort of that the next generational female relocates the fungus, and the whole cycle starts anew. We know she relocates the fungus because lots of these kinds of insects, she has mycangia where she packs fungus in. So what you're looking at here is the hind end of a female, and blue stain are the little fungal conidia that are packed in there that she's going to use to basically create this, which are these fungus that provides nutrition for her offspring. Okay? So here's where it gets complex, and stick with me on this. If you look across all of these different host plants, one of the first things you observe when you look at these galls is that there's tremendous phenotypic diversity in gall shape and size and form. All right? So phenotypes are diverse, right? And we've been interested in, we figured that if we can understand the mechanisms that are driving phenotypic diversification, we can understand something about the mechanism of diversification itself. That, what I just said, in a nutshell, is exactly, so here's what I mean when I say variation in gall phenotypes. So here's a gall phenotype, and here's a gall phenotype, and those are absolutely stereotypic. They don't vary, okay? When I told you that I'm interested in the mechanisms that explain this phenotypic variation, it's exactly this question. It's exactly this. So I've given this talk before where I waved my hands for 15 minutes trying to explain this, and somebody raised their hand and said, isn't that just like the beak's finch, or the beak of the finches? I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what it's like, right? So we're interested in phenotypic diversification and understanding the mechanisms that promote that diversification. So it's exactly that. So the question is, what are the mechanisms? What is that mechanism? And the one, so again, here's the summary of the phenotypic, not only do they differ in sort of shape, so the some galls are thick and some are thin, but there's other life history characteristics that vary as well. But the trick to understanding what those different phenotypes mean, so we know that the beak of the finch means something about eating seeds of different sizes, right? And so thanks to the grants, we have one of the best examples of evolution we could possibly have thanks to their years of work. What do these phenotypes mean? What do these gall phenotypes mean? Well, it turns out, we want to know what they mean, we can go back to those scale insects, that crazy scale insect story that I told you. So what they mean is this. So this is from Couch 1931. Talking about the scale insects now, not the flies, he said, a few simple observations and measurements will show the fungus often affords a very distinct protection to the scale insect against their most formidable enemies, which happen to be these wasps. It turns out that thicker fungus means only wasps with longer ovipositors can attack the scale insect way down in there, right? And that's bad for the fungus because she wants to keep the fungus wants to keep the scale insect alive as long as possible. Okay? So thicker mat means short ovipositor parasitoids can't reach her. Okay? Turns out that's exactly what's going on with these gall midges. So here you're seeing a drawing from Art Weiss, who basically proposed this back in the 80s. And here you see a short ovipositor wasp that's unhappy. Here's a happy, a long ovipositor wasp that can get its eggs right in there, right next to the larvae. And so it turns out that diversification, divergent selection on these phenotypes are being driven probably by parasitoid wasps. So here is some data that my buddy John Steyerman produced, where he shows that platygaster, for example, really prefers galls of this thickness, really prefers and really avoids galls that are like this, right? So these different phenotypes correspond in a really amazing way with the types of parasitoids that attack these different galls, right? So top-down selection on phenotypes, not bottom-up. So now you're going to say, well, okay, your whole story is just look at the coevolution then between the fly and the fungus, because that's obviously the story here. Not Ehrlich and Raven between plants and insects, but Ehrlich and Raven, or some kind of coevolutionary story between the fungal mutualist and the plant. Once you understand that, you can explain all of this phenotype stuff. Well, here's the problem. The gall polymorphisms are not caused by the fungus at all. How do I know that? Well, summarizing a lot of work here, I can tell you that if you take fungi from flies from across North America, even flies from South Africa, do AFOPs on them, you find that they're essentially using the same haplotype to form these different galls. So different niche lineages here are all using the same fungus to form these different galls. Okay? So these different phenotypes all come from the same genotype of fungus. So how's that possible? Well, it's really not that complex, because these are essentially extended phenotypes of the midges. So the heritable components of those phenotypes in fungus are not in the fungus, but actually are in the midge. So it's like this. Gall lineage 1 causes this kind of gall. So midge lineage 1 causes this kind of gall. Midge lineage 2 might cause this kind of gall. So those phenotypes then are encoded by something in these genomes, in the midge genomes, not in the fungal genomes. They're extended phenotypes, right? Happens all the time in plants and gall-forming insects. Okay, you with me? So here's our working model. The midge lineage causes the midges cause some kind of host-plant response. They recruit fungus to the plant, and it grows in a certain shape. There's phenotypic adaptation across host plants and natural enemies, and there's diversification through ecologically mediated speciation. So if we want to understand what the target of natural selection for this interaction then is and link natural selection to diversification, the target's going to be somewhere here. We've got to understand the interaction between this, how these different midge lineages produce and regulate these different fungal phenotypes. That's going to be the target. That's what natural selection is acting on. That's then going to allow us to understand this pattern, I would argue, at least part of it. Now, why do I have that there? Because this is a wood wasp, not a fly. Because I want to tell you that how she does this is really interesting. How she gets this fungus to grow in these pines is really interesting. So these horntails, they use these beautiful ovipositors to pour into wood. And at the base of that ovipositor, she's got this little sac of mucus that she then inoculates into the wood. And the fungus will only grow if she inoculates the tree with this, whatever's in this sac, which actually has been understudied, nobody knows. Well, there's very little known about that. And why am I telling you that? Because it allows me to tell you about carotenoids. And this is where the story gets a little bit even more unusual. So carotenoids, you guys know what carotenoids are. You eat your eat your carrots, and everything's good for your eyesight. They're isoprenoid pigments, so they're pigments. And they're missing in our diet. That's why we have to eat them in our vegetables, right? And they provide all kinds of things, antioxidants, defense, vision, signaling, and such, things like that. And it turns out, so here's the biosynthetic pathway for carotenoids. So they're isoprenoids. There's these condensation reactions and these cyclation reactions, these desaturations, that then produce all these downstream products for virtually all of life, okay, to use. So our beta carotenes and our taurolines, and these downstream products of these long carbon molecules then can be chopped up and recombined, and things can be added that can provide all kinds of useful molecules for metabolic and hormonal action. For example, in plants, abscisic acid, a very important plant compound, hormone, is a essentially a downstream product of carotenoid biosynthesis. And fungi, trisporic acids are important in mating and growth. Obviously, retinoic acid is important in vision for us. But we're missing these two genes that provide this initial step in this pathway. So we don't have those two genes. But if we had them, we could just make our own carotenoids. We wouldn't have to eat carrots anymore. So we have to eat them. And there's trade-offs associated. If you're into birds, you know that sexual selection, a lot of it's based on trade-offs associated with carotenoids, because you have to either put them in your feathers or use them for your health, but you can't do both, right? So there's a lot, they're really important in sexual selection in invertebrates. Now, about 3 years ago, a paper was published actually by my PhD advisor where in aphids, it was discovered that aphids actually have those two genes for carotenoid biosynthesis. So what you're looking at here is a fungus tree. Here are the P. aphids here, the gene tree for one of these genes. And this gene is from aphids, is embedded in this fungus tree, the telltale sign of lateral gene transfer. So aphids acquired from fungi those genes for carotenoid biosynthesis. So you've got these red and these green P. aphids, and I won't tell you the story behind that, but it's actually a really interesting one. Spider mites, turns out, have the genes as well. Now, we had long been interested in carotenoids because we knew how that many of our larvae were very orange. Not only were their larvae orange, but many of their salivary glands and accessory glands and various other secretory glands were highly enriched in carotenoids, which we assumed they had been getting from the plants. But it turns out that, and so we've long been interested in carotenoids. It turns out that gall midges have the genes as well. So gall midges are the third case of insects that have the ability to de novo produce carotenoids in addition to dietary acquisition. Right? Turns out it's a monophyletic group, and I can talk to you about this if you're interested later, about what does that imply about what's going on there, the fact that they seem to all have acquired the same the genes from the same group of fungi as well. All right, you still with me on this? Okay, so what we've been interested in then is we said, well, what kind of variation in carotenoids are we seeing across that phylogeny of midges that differ in whether they're herbivores or ambrosia gallers or predators? Do we see variation? And so what you're looking at here is a little sort of carotenoid profile we did of the host plants of one of those gall midges, Astromyia. So this is a little heat map. This means that this particular molecule is really common, less common, less missing altogether. Little, what's in the plant? What are they actually eating when they eat a goldenrod? When you look at an herbivore, you can see that this is what they consume, and then they must metabolize it into these. Right? So this is taurolene, really common in the herbivore gall midges, right? But what's interesting is when you look at the fungus gall. So this is a fungus galler partitioned by different tissues, okay? So these are accessory glands, salivary glands, and ovaries. And you can see it looks completely different than the herbivore. Moreover, if you look at the numbers down here, you can see that this fungus galler is for some reason packing its accessory glands with carotenoids. Just packing them in there. So why is it doing that? Well, it turns out, it's really interesting. So here's these accessory glands, they're bright orange. And it turns out that the carotenoids actually predict attack by these platygaster wasps. So these crescent galls, which have are really enriched in their accessory glands, these carotenoids, are preferred by these platygasters. And there's this amazing kind of correlation. This is not a manipulative experiment, so there's all the caveats about correlations, but it is what it is, right? So there seems to be some relationship between the content of these accessory glands and some kind of multitrophic consequence. Moreover, you could tell me, well, that's just the carotenoids they're getting from their diet, and they're just metabolizing in that kind of way. Well, I would say that could be what's going on. However, if you actually look again, across, use that sort of fungus present, fungus absent contrast, and actually ask how are these genes expressed across these different species that have these different interactions. Here's what you see. So this is qPCR assays of species with and without fungal mutualis. And it turns out that the larvae of species that are ambrosiacal, or so fungal mutualist larvae, are really ramping up the expression of those two genes that they acquired from fungi relative to the larvae of those that are basically herbivores. Essentially, these genes are turned off in adults. So adults are non-feeding, they're basically turned off. Okay. So there is this variation across lifestyle in how these genes are expressed that are laterally acquired. So here's our working model. The Mitch lineage, that somehow carotenoids were important in this particular, this aspect of this interaction. We believe that carotenoids are important in fungal recruitment and growth. And so we think that, therefore, that carotenoids are precisely the target of natural selection that may help us to understand these kind of phenotypic divergence and ultimately diversification. We're not saying it's the only part of the story, but we're thinking it's part of the story. So summary then on gall midges, how are they associated, how have they co-evolved? There are complex patterns of midge diversification with host, across host plants, but little genetic variation in the fungal mutualist. What do they do for each other? They provide nutrition and defense, dispersal and competitive advantages for fungal mutualist probably, and how they work. A lot of work to be done here, but we think carotenoids, which are, weirdly enough, laterally acquired from fungi, are important in the maintenance and diversification of these fungal mutualisms. All right? And so it's sort of interesting to think about the fact that somewhere in the past, there was this link between an animal and a fungus that ultimately led to an ecological link between an animal and a fungus. Okay. All right, so let me talk a little bit more briefly then on social evolution, some work I've done with aphids. So when you think about advanced complex sociality, you're talking about ants and bees and complex overlapping generations, so eusocial organisms, superorganisms, right? And the reason that many of us are interested in eusociality is because even though it's ecologically successful, so there's no question that leafcutter ants are ecologically successful organisms, eusociality itself is phylogenetically rare. So it's that combination of ecological success on one hand and lack of it being common in the tree of life on the other that makes it interesting, because you say, what are the problems with crossing that threshold, that new transition into another level of organization? So that's sort of some of the big questions then in social evolution are things like this, is can we identify the homologies across socially living taxa? And are there ecological, demographic, life history predictors, genomic predictors of sociality that allow us to understand what it means to cross that threshold into a more complex level of organization? But it turns out that since I graduated from graduate school, or at least when I was graduating from graduate school, there's been a lot of work done on things that are not ants and bees. There's an entirely new beastry of organisms to work on to understand social evolution. And in fact, that's what I've done then for a number of years, is to work on these aphids, these social aphids, which are these simple little societies that tell us a little bit about social evolution. So when we look at sociality, we can actually break it down into this, make a main division between two different types. There's some social insects that are, in which the basic altruistic act is brood care. Basically, that's what they do. They take care of the offspring of their mother in many cases. But there's another kind of society, and these are the fortress defenders, as David Queller and Joan Strassman so usefully describe them, where their basic altruistic act is not brood care, mostly because they live in their food, but defense of the group. So defense is their main expression of altruism. And that's where the aphids lie, and that's what I want to talk to you about today. So social aphids, so yes, you all know what aphids are, but the social aphids occur in a couple of subfamilies that you're probably less familiar with, down here that are not in this huge group of things like P. aphids that you may be familiar with. what's really interesting about social aphids is that, like our gall-forming midges with their fungus, there's tremendous phylogenetic lability in this trait. And that allows us then to do interesting comparative biology across these phylogenies. So a social aphid social society looks something like this. You have a single reproductive female, and all she does is asexually produces an army of daughters that defend her and each other. They live in a gall, so this is what the green part is, plant tissue, on which they feed. She, the big queen, then larva deposits without sex, her daughters, her clonal daughters, they then aggressively defend the group. Ultimately, some of them grow up and develop wings and leave the group. And so the goal of this society is to produce these reproductives. Okay? Very simple society, not like going on in terms of complexity like ants, but nevertheless, the basic acts are there because defending this group is an altruistic act. And explaining that is the goal and part of social evolutionary biology. All right, here's what it looks like. So there's a sulfide larvae. If you flick her in, she falls in, and then she's swarmed by all these little aphids with their little waxy hind parts, and ultimately she's actually killed, and appears to be some painful way. So I feel bad about that every time I show it. These aphids that I study are common throughout North America in a genus that attacks poplars. So they're on many different poplars across North America. And what's really interesting about them is that some are social, some have these little societies, and some species do not. So in blue here, you see those with those societies. In absence of blue, you see there's not. So you've got these nice little contrasts between species that have soldiers and those that don't, allowing us to compare between those that do and those that do not. Right? So what do? They attack and kill natural enemies while social aphids do not. So when you ask, what is a social aphid? I'll tell you, it's something that attacks other insects. Right? That's what a social aphid is. That's the definition of it. Every other aphid on the planet drops off the leaf, runs away, flies away, is scared, whatever. These don't. They run towards you, they'll attack your finger, they'll do whatever they can to basically sting you. So, if you don't believe me, so here is one of those non-social ones. Here's the founders here, here's the predator here. Here's all the little honeydew balls that are encased in wax nicely. And here is a poor second instar larvae that's kind of like saying, please don't drag me away, and she's kind of going to be dragged away. But here's what happens when you take that same predator and drop it in a social aphid gall. It is swarmed, starts to rise so fast the camera can't keep up with it. Eventually, it's immobilized and dies. And they don't let go. They're basically die there. These little social aphid soldiers, they die there. So it's truly an altruistic act. I think that's what I just showed you. Oh, this is anthochorid. Same thing, really quickly, just because I hate anthochorids. They're really nasty predators if you're into this kind of thing, and they kill your aphids. But not these aphids. These aphids, the anthochorid gets really hammered, and that's why I love this video. So the anthochorid's in there somewhere, and it's dead. And that's really kind of amazing, because if you know anthochorids, it would be like, I don't know, it would be like some little antelopes killing a big male lion or something like that. It just doesn't make sense, but it works somehow. And that's what I want to tell you about in the last few minutes. So basically, believe me that they can kill chrysopids or anthochorids, so these are controls. Those are the survivorship of chrysopids in an open container. They basically just dry out eventually. And those with aphids, so they basically get killed. And for a reason that I'll tell you for in just a few minutes, they also kill Drosophila larvae as well. Not surprisingly, they kill anthochorids, they're going to kill Drosophila larvae. So basically, social aphids, you can just do these experiments again and again and again. Drop whatever you want in, it gets killed. Right? Okay. So what's actually going on? What explains sociality in aphids? Let me tell you really quickly, just so that you know something about sociality in aphids. There's a lot of ecological explanation for sociality, but one of them is not the fact that they live in galls, right? all social agents form galls at some point in their life cycle. The problem is, and so they provide, galls provide things like clonal integrity or provide something to defend. They constrain growth rates and things like that. And there are other correlates. The problem is that all of these things form galls. So galls themselves explain nothing about the trait variation of sociality, right? So I've gone through this in grant reviews a million times, and I'm like, it's not galls because it's not explaining the absence, right? Anyway, all right, so can you hear, like, you younger people, when you hear, like, a professor do that, you know that, like, there's anger management issues because of grant reviews. But anyway, and then predation and ant-tending, there's a lot of stuff going on. But here's what I think actually is going on. So that's an open question if you want to work on social agents. I think I need to understand defense. I think I need to actually understand actually what is going on when those aphids attack those victims. And I think that then is going to be the target of natural selection. Okay? So when aphids attack an insect, apparently what happens is the insect dies because it has a massive melanization response. So this Drosophila right here became this Drosophila here within about 30 minutes, okay, after being attacked by all these soldiers. And so there's this massive wounding coagulation response, which is basically what in insects is, melanization is, and is typically used for encapsulating parasitoids or encapsulating bacteria in their wounds. But these guys are experiencing basically toxic melanization shock. So, if you don't believe me really quickly here, this is just a time series. Here's our controls. Here is what happens when you just stab. I had these undergrads do this. They really enjoyed it. Stab a bunch of Drosophila with needles. They kind of wound like that. These are sterile needles. But with the soldiers, these Drosophila larvae invariably become blackened and melanized. Why does that matter? Well, it turns out, really quickly, there's lots of toxic intermediates in this melanization cascade, this immune response, that are not good to have in large quantities. And that's why insects regulate the melanization response very tightly. It's a very tightly regulated cascade in insects. And that's exactly why in other social insects and some other insects that use venoms dysregulate that melanization response as a means to immobilize their victims. So it's part of the poison repertoire, or the venom repertoire, sorry, of many insects that do actually use venoms, right? So that would not be unusual if the melanization response is exactly what those social aphids are targeting. So here's our working model. Altruistic defense in aphids involves the secretion of venoms, venomous factors that attack the immune defenses of enemies. Again, let me back up. Again, we're talking about phytophagous insects. Right? So the reason this matters, if I was telling you this about a bee, you would go, yeah, so tell me something new. I'm talking about an herbivorous insect that somehow dysregulates the immune system of its host. That then facilitates group living, because if you're going to be a soft-bodied aphid, you can't live in a group if you can't defend yourself. Once you can live in a group, you can acquire new other social complexities by virtue of the fact that you're living in a group and you're effectively defending yourself. And so you have these adaptations then, and this increase in social complexity once you can live in a group and defend yourself. So that then is the target of natural selection. That, if we can understand that, we might understand this trait variation, okay? We know that there are venomous aphids, and we know they use proteolytic enzymes, but not in the species, not the groups that I study, right? So we know it's a legitimate question. So what we've been doing then is asking, how does the melanization response, how is it cued, and what is the basic pattern in our little lab rat, Drosophila? What does that look like when they're attacked by aphids? And so I'll run you through some really quick qPCR assays. I'm down to 3 minutes of my talk, so nobody panic. So we basically have been going through this melanization biochemical pathway, basically saying, how are these genes expressed before and after attack by social aphids, right? What does this look like after attack? And here's what it looks like. So here are some qPCR results. So I'll just walk through these really quickly. So what you can see here is, here's the basic experiment. There's a control, no attack by aphids. Here's Drosophila that we stab a lot. And then here's the drosophila that are attacked by aphids. And you can see in every case, in these four genes anyway, of course I left out the ones that don't fit the pattern. But these are upregulated, usually by about twofold, in this case particular, in this case here, in this case here, after attack by these social aphids. So there's this transcriptional response, or else they're just dying, after attack by these social aphids. So the immune system of these insects are feeling the attack by social aphids. In fact, what you can do then is take mutants in each of those different genes and say, are they then immune to attack by these aphids? Can they survive attack if they cannot invoke the melanization response? And in fact, you do see that. So for example, this you get partial rescue in this phenyloxidase mutant when they're attacked by aphids because they can't turn on the melanization response. So summary then on aphids, I told you it's only 3 minutes. Social aphids have acquired traits for the secretion of venom factors that attack immunity-related responses in natural enemies. There's convergence here with the venom components of other social arthropods, which are, by and large, hymenoptera and predators anyway, okay? So, but you've had, I would argue, convergence from way over here in herbivory, way over here to what the hymenoptera were sort of already doing anyway before they became social. The precursors for these venom factors are likely related to overcoming plant defenses, because I haven't told you this, because I don't have the data for reasons I told you, that they're probably proteolytic enzymes. And so here's my final pitch then. What do we get out of studying these other kinds of social insects that aren't ants and termites? What you get are things like this, that you can study social evolution, but in this case, you can put it on an edifice of insect immunity. So you can link insect immunity, which is obviously a huge field, to social evolution. And you can rest all that on top of coevolution between plants and insects. Because where did the pre-adaptations for those venoms come from? Well, they didn't come from, again, being predators like Hymenoptera. They came from probably figuring out how to avoid invoking plant defenses and how to eat a plant. They then became co-opted for use for defense, which then conferred the ability to live in groups for these phytophagous insects. So I think it's kind of interesting then to think about both of these projects. In one case, you had plant-insect antagonism, which, and on top of that is a mutualism between a plant and a fungus. So these are plant-eating fungi and plant-eating insects that have a mutualism. They're probably using the components of a history of plant-insect antagonism. And you see exactly the same thing in social aphids, that again, the building blocks of that cooperative interaction are built out of antagonism with plants. Okay, thank you very much.
We might have time for just one or two questions.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's awfully idiosyncratic then for those aphids as to whether or not that did lead to soldiers, right? Because you see them intermingled there. So, do you think we'll ever get any predictive power out of that, given how seemingly serendipitous it is?
No, I hear you. And so, I'm not saying that's the whole story, but it would be interesting to find out if there are. So, maybe it won't explain the trait variation within that genus, but it would be really interesting to find out whether across all social aphids there are. So, one of the things I've become really interested in is whether they are sequestering plant metabolites, secondary metabolites, as part of that venomous cocktail that they are then basically regurgitating into their victims. And we actually do have some evidence that in fact they are. So they're actually harvesting from poplars bioactive molecules that appear to be useful to them in immobilizing. So it's not a part of the whole story, but you're exactly right. It doesn't explain, it can't explain if they're all attacking the same host plant. It can't explain that trait variation in sociality itself. But it does allow me to actually look, though, at whether there has been, for example, gene duplication, increased rates of selection on the genes that underlie whatever their for example, those serine proteases that they're probably introducing into their victim. So I can at least say, what does the genome, how does it respond to sociality and social aphids? Because I now know what is being targeted in those genomes. But you're right, in terms of explanation, it can't be the whole story.
Okay,
second
question.
Thank you.